Welcome to Agile Self-Development, the podcast that gives you a roadmap for personal growth and self-improvement for your body, mind, and spirit. Hi, I'm Helene Coppell, and I'll show you how to become your best self one version at a time. Many of us have heard about the mind-body connection and even have examples from your life to prove it. I've got a recurring rash that shows up in times of my biggest stresses, right on my legs and my arms. When I'm feeling really upset emotionally, my heart starts to race, my fingers shake, and I get queasy. On the flip side, when I go to my yoga class, that physical practice brings me into a calm state of mind, which isn't easy when you've got an overactive one like mine. So I've got no doubt in that body-mind connection. The proof is in the pudding for me. My guest today is somatic therapist and author Todd Nils Nyholm. Through both personal and professional experience, he's discovered the undeniable relationship between mind and body. When stress, poor mental mindset, and negative external experiences all come together, Todd maintains that the needs of the body are often the first thing we ignore. We also tend to ignore preserving our rich inner world. His new book called Ah, Brain, Why Do You Trouble Me So Much? Speaks to rechanneling your mindset from self-imposed boundaries. It speaks to breaking the chains from external expectations, to making courageous decisions, prioritizing your mind, body, and loved ones over your work and your other stresses, and about reorienting your inner compass. And now, on with the interview. Todd, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here and talk with you.
Thank you. Now, if you've heard some episodes, you know I always like to start with the very basics for terms that some people may not be familiar with. So you are a somatic therapist. Can you share what somatic therapy is and how you got into it?
Sure. We use it kind of as a catch-all term for the work that I do because we use seven or eight different kinds of therapies with different names that no one understands or knows. So we just kind of shorten it down to somatic therapist. Somatic refers to the body. And so in this case, we're working through the body to make changes in people's health any way we can. And we use methods like visceral manipulation or cranial sacral therapy or shiatsu or acupressure. And I use all those things at the clinic to help people get well any way that I can.
What does a somatic therapy session look like?
Kind of depends on who I'm working
with. For example.
I definitely have someone on a table. And so I'm working on their body with my hands and fingers and knuckles. I'm talking to them throughout the session to see where they are. And I might ask them questions to see what lights up in their body. And then I'll work through their body to make adjustments in how they feel. So I might ask you how your workday is and feel your neck and then see how stressed you are, the areas of your life that kind of get things going. And then I'll usually get to a place where I ask you what you're interested in or where you like your life to go, things that you're excited about to kind of get your nervous system to switch over. And in the meantime, I might work on your neck to kind of help your body go from a sympathetic to a parasympathetic state and make some changes going through the body as well as talking and working through things.
Right. That sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, I'm just going to point out I have a lot of friends in the yogi community, and I'm a certified teacher. And that's something, you know, we understand that you have your rest and digest is the parasympathetic, right? And the sympathetic is there a rhyming one? Do we have a rhyming one like rest and digest? I know it's more active.
It's more like fight or flight and active.
Fight or flight.
Yeah.
I should edit myself for forgetting that fight or flight.
We'll get there together.
Thank you. And you know what? My daughter has been advocating for somatic therapy as well. And she told me she has done some somatic art therapy. Uh-huh. So do you incorporate art into your practice?
No, I haven't. It'd be interesting to do. I think you could probably get some interesting results doing it that way. I haven't even tried to branch into that part of it yet.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, creative types would be really attuned to it. But let's get back to your book.
All right.
Right. Let's talk about your new book, Brain, Why Do You Trouble Me So Much? Tell me how this came to be and what it's all about.
Sure. As I was putting together some work that I wanted to develop for myself, which I call the Nitality System, I wanted to write a book that connected all the principles together. So the first book I wrote had to do with diet, and it was pretty focused. And as I was writing other books, I realized I needed a book that covered a lot of the picture, like the principles in a big picture sort of way. And so I ended up writing a second book, and then I realized I needed to connect them. And I wrote this third book, which I published as the second book to kind of help connect everything. So it's a very big picture book, and it works from the inside out. It works with your mind and your emotions and your body in some interesting ways. trying to get you to focus on yourself more than your external environment in order to make changes in your life and how you feel. And so there's a lot of great principles in there. And I kind of use a laddering system to work from principle to principle so that people can connect them all together so they're not all randomly just put in different places.
So is this the Nitality method? Is that described in your book?
It is. It's big pieces of it. So the system I've built is actually really large and I'm trying to find ways to teach it. So some of it's physical exercises, some of it's mental, some of it's emotional, some of it has to do with money and success. And it's the same principles built in a lot of different ways. And so I originally called the work the Nyhome Vital Life Method, which was way too long. And one of my editors is like, why don't we shorten that? And so that eventually became Nitality Method. So it's just...
It's catchy.
And it makes more sense. You can see how I got to it.
Yeah. So in there, you speak about self-imposed boundaries. Give me an idea what that looks like and how those self-imposed boundaries affect us.
Sure. People get these boundaries where they think they can and can't go. And often they pick them up when they're kids. We get this kind of programming from our family and from our society and from school that you can do these things and you can't do those things. And you can do these things because you're male and you can do these things because you're female and because you're this age or you're that age. And we start to believe it because everyone told us that. And often it's before you're seven, before your mind has a chance to say, wait, that does not make any idea at all. So maybe your dad says, hey, we're blue collar people and you can't do anything past that. But you might really wish to be an academic. And so you'd have this boundary that you kind of end up reinforcing that someone else gave you. And so one of the big things I talk about in the book is trying to help people to see the programming and then break it down to see that it wasn't even really their idea and they're reinforcing it and they're living in these boxes that other people gave them.
Yeah. I feel like I can relate. That often happens to us when we're young, right? The influence that we build ourselves imposing boundaries on very often it's based in childhood. I found myself, I think, you know, you can tell me if I'm not really talking about a boundary, but I found myself through, you know, years of reading self-help books and self-improvement that there's this thing about positivity.
Right.
You have to be positive. And the things with the laws of attraction, like if you're negative or, you know, if you allow yourself angry feelings that, you know, you're contributing to the negativity and your life is going to be, you know, it's self-fulfilling prophecy that things are going to go bad. And so I went through a very stressful period believing I always had to be positive.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people get stuck there. They get stuck in these ideas that they found, they feel really profound, but when you analyze them, they kind of lead you into a like a wall almost where you can't get around it, you know, because life has all kinds of things happening. Some of it's going to feel positive to you. Some of it's going to feel negative. Some of it's going to be painful. Some of it's going to be pleasurable. And it can be easy to get stuck into all those different areas, you know? And so you get an idea and then you build a wall around it and around your life and you can get really stuck into things. And so particularly with emotions, people tend to either suppress them or they allow them to run them all over the place, you know, and there's this nice place in the middle where you can really get good with them and you can really get, some interesting skill. And I like to say you conduct your emotions in that state like a symphony orchestra. And so you have these different emotions, then they have their own voice. And you're not suppressing them, but they don't get to ruin the whole piece by being out of alignment with everything else. And so I think emotions, you know, they're particularly in our culture, we don't talk about them very much. Some of the ancient cultures talked about them more. I remember tripping over this term when I was a kid in Ayurveda that they had emotional and mental hygiene and that they would teach their kids and teach each other. And now we don't seem to have much like that at all. It's like these emotions bad, these emotions kind of okay, you know.
Are those self-imposed boundaries as well, right? That what we are allowed to feel.
Absolutely. And then you're narrowing your experience of life. And I'm not saying it's a good idea to hang out in anger for 20 years or things like that, because I have clients like that. And it really takes a toll on your nervous system and some other interesting things. But there's a time where it's really useful. You may be in an abusive relationship or situation. And that's when the anger is meant to drive you forward and get you out of it so that you see some different things, because it's kind of an explosive emotion. There's a time and place for it. You just don't want it to eat the cake. You got to get everything else in there, you know, so.
Yeah. So what are some of the tools we have to rechannel those boundaries?
I think the first step, like if you're looking for tools, is to start watching yourself. Is when you're going through your daily life. So there's a principle I ran across when I was like 8 or 9 in the library at one of my schools and some old books. And they talked about giving yourself half your attention during the day and the rest of your life half the attention. And you're doing it simultaneously. So like I'm talking to you, but I'm also watching my mind and I'm also listening to what I say, what my body's doing, what emotions I have. Pretty soon it opens up a whole bunch of things you don't know you're really experiencing because your emotions are fast and your mind is fast. And there's a bunch of things that are flying by that you don't realize are happening until you really start to practice that. And so the first step is to do this without judgment. Don't judge yourself for it, but just really start to watch. What's my mind doing? What are my emotions doing? Can I label this emotion? Do I know what it is I'm feeling? Do I know what thoughts are flying by? And pretty soon you'll start to develop your own color palette of what the emotions feel like and what thoughts you tend to think. You're probably thinking the same thoughts 9 out of 10 thoughts a day. And so it's an interesting thing to work through, and you can build a set of tools from there.
So you're kind of creating your own statistics, right? You measure.
Yeah, you're measuring yourself.
Your feelings. There's some multitasking involved with that.
Well, first, it's observation, you know, and you, if you try to control everything, you won't be able to do it. It's observation. And I don't know if you've ever played those video games where you can like toggle your character in and out. So sometimes you see yourself on the screen and sometimes you don't. This is just putting yourself on the screen of your awareness so that it's always kind of giving you, you're getting a little information about yourself as you go through it. But you don't want to control it. You don't want to judge it, or you'll drive yourself crazy. And don't try to do this when you're driving at first. That's, you know, that's not the time.
Don't try this at home, kids.
That's right.
Right. Don't operate heavy machinery while you're observing yourself.
At least not till you get good at it. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about those external expectations. That's kind of almost hand in hand, right? With the self-imposed boundaries is those expectations. So maybe you can share more about how you talk about it in the book.
Well, in some ways, it's the outside force that's the same thing that's working on you to give you boundaries. And sometimes that looks like, you know, people wanting you to do X because they would feel good about it. Or sometimes it's family, or sometimes it's work, or any kind of organization you can be in where people have expectations that don't necessarily meet what you need or want. And so you're trying to live up to things that you didn't decide for yourself. And sometimes it's in alignment. Sometimes they're helping you. And other times it's totally 180 degrees from where you want to go, and so you end up spending your life living for somebody else. I think one of the worst things that I've seen people go through working at the clinic is they'll be 96 and they'll say to me, oh, I didn't do any of the things I wanted to. I just did what my mom told me that I should be doing. And now I regret the 9 decades I left, or I've lived through so far. So it's kind of a big deal, I think, to really figure out what you want. And then the expectations can kind of fall away a little bit, or you can see if they jive with where you want to go.
And courageous decisions. What makes a decision courageous?
So courage literally has this root of the heart. And so in a way, you're coming from your own deepest center, whether that's popular or not, and even if you like it or not. So it may be that you have difficulty speaking on stage, but to accomplish what you want to do, you have to get out there, make yourself seen and make yourself known. And so you're really bringing out this part of you that's a little different. And it does tend to wake up this kind of feeling in your heart where you're courageous and roaring a bit into the world, even if that's a bit quiet from the way other people see it. You're making some different decisions and going in some different directions.
Creates a state of vulnerability, I would say.
Absolutely. It's very vulnerable. And a lot of people won't do the things they love or want because it makes them vulnerable, like putting themselves out there. For instance, when I wrote my first book, I didn't tell anyone I wrote it until it was done. And then I had it done. I had it like in the Amazon store and it was out there, and I told some people and they're like, oh, no, you'll never be able to write a book. I'm like, no, it's done. And they're like,
it's done.
You'll never finish it. I'm like, no, it's done. Like, you'll never publish it. I'm like, no, it's out there. Open up your phone, look at it. And it was that kind of weird resistance and expectations of why anyone couldn't write a book if you really wanted to.
Right. And I have to say there was probably, let's go into your psyche. Why didn't you tell anyone you were writing a book until it was done?
Because I'd gotten so much resistance before in all kinds of ways. So I somewhat expected that kind of reaction from people. And I knew that if I just put my head down and worked, then I could kind of get where I wanted to go. And there's this old saying, and I can't remember where it's originally from, but it's something like, tell the world what you're going to do, but first show them. And so I just put it all together. And when I first needed some advice, I found an editor who was a professional and had done it for years. And she said, hey, I'll tell you the truth. If it's terrible, I'll let you know. So I sent it to her and she read it and she's like, oh, this is good. You can do something with this. And that gave me some confidence to break out from there.
Yeah. Actions speak louder than words, right? There's another way to do it. I want to flip to your other book.
Sure.
Okay. It is called Ah, Food, Why Do You Trouble Me So Much? And it's 14 mental and emotional steps you need before you take one more bite. So those who follow me, know me, listen to the podcast often, know that I have spent a lifetime on a journey around dealing with a food addiction and compulsive eating.
Yeah.
So can you tell me the backstory on that book?
Sure. So I had health problems since I was a kid, and a lot of them focused in on my digestion, elimination, assimilation, all that kind of thing. So I always had digestive issues. And as I was growing up, I was trying to find any way to help myself. And when I talked to the doctors, they often didn't have a lot of advice for me. It was sort of live on ibuprofen or Pepto-Bismol, those kinds of things. And so I started trying to figure it out on my own. And that led me through about every diet you could possibly imagine. If there's one out there, I've probably tried it. And at some point, I really needed to figure something out.
We could probably have a competitive game over that.
Yeah, probably. probably both close, you know. It's so I tried everything I could think of. And eventually I was like, you know, I'm going to have to do this a different way. The force mechanic I can't make work, which is something like, hey, I'm going to live on broccoli water for 6 months or something. It's really difficult to do and it's not sustainable. And so I was like, well, what if I commit this from the inside out? You know, and so I'm like, okay, let's build a series of steps I can use. And the 14 steps, they're meant to be used like right when you sit down to eat. And so you sit down and you say, okay, I eat to nourish myself in my life. And then maybe you're looking at a tub of ice cream and Doritos and all kinds of weird things. And you're like, well, that isn't going to nourish where I want to go. And there might be a time for that, but at least you're having the conversation with yourself. And so it wakes you up out of the, hey, I worked all day and I'm tired. And so now my reward is a bag of potato chips. Or my parents always did this at this time. And it so breaks you out of that habit that you might have picked up when you were a kid. And with that, I lost about 60 pounds, a couple few months. And I'm down, you know, I've maintained it since I've done it that way. But I'm not using any kind of like force mechanic. I'm not using like, I can only eat these things at those times. I'm letting my body decide a lot of that. And that takes a lot of like watching yourself, like I was talking about before. And it's one of those things that really connects between the two books. So it worked great for me and it's worked great for a few of my clients. It really was a little different way for me to approach it. Worked great for me. Then I wanted to share it with other people that were like me.
And it sounds like there's a bit of the idea around intuitive eating in there. Like for me, I've said, I always maintained up until recently that there's no such thing as intuitive eating for me. Because my compulsion, my addiction, intuition says, eat, you'll feel better, right?
Right.
So it's only recently that, you know, I come into, if I can avoid the food, the addictive substances that create the craving,
sure,
that I could quiet that voice long enough to know what my real intuition is, right? So we have two different patterns here, right? We can be intuitive in that I can calm my nerves by eating a pint of ice cream, or I can use that intuition to say, my intuition tells me that if I eat that pint of ice cream, I'm really going to be miserable, right?
Longer term. Yeah. And I think there's a few things there. Like we have that intuitive kind of experience, but we also have something going on in our body. And so most of us, when we eat, we're not in our body at all. And I think one of the best things people can do is to actually feel their body and then look at the food and see how the body responds. And so it's less intuitive as it is your body saying, you know, I'm not so sure that those Doritos are going to be useful right now, because I might put my hand on a Dorito and I'll feel my gut. It'll give me a little reaction like, oh, I don't want that right now. But if I hadn't learned how to stop myself, slow down a little bit, get in my body and then touch it, I might have missed that whole thing. And so you can have a little bit of that. You can have a little bit of the intuition. And then I think we don't talk enough about the chemistry of the body, because sometimes reading things to fix something that's off with the chemistry. And so in that case, you're going to have to like make some interesting changes to figure out how to deal with it. So you might have problems with sugar or salt or, you know, something like that. You're really exhausted at 3. And you don't know why, and you don't know that's a sign of some adrenal problems. And so you want a whole bag of potato chips and a bunch of coffee or something to get yourself through the rest of the day. And so there's a lot of things like that. It's a big picture thing. And that's one of the things I really try to get at. It's like, how do you hit it from 36 different sides so that you can make a change long term that's sustainable? And so you don't lose 50 pounds and then gain 75. And then, you know, because I watch a lot of my clients do that. They lose 100 pounds and gain back 120 because they would use some really strict diet, but they couldn't maintain it. And they never sort of addressed what was really driving them to the behavior to begin with.
Right. Yeah. I have found that this diet industry is so hurtful.
Oh, yeah. And they motivate you, I think, in a lot of ways with that sort of hurtful comment. And
you're
you see,
dangling a carrot.
Oh, yeah. And then you're kind of attacking them through the back door, too. Like there's something wrong with you if you're not super fit, like as a person.
Yeah.
And that really bothers me in the way they talk about, like, that's not true. You're just having a problem with your diet or in your fitness, or maybe you have a distinct health problem that needs to be addressed. Maybe your hormones are really off and your body's like showing you in this kind of out of the way of getting it across to you. And you need to check out how your health is doing overall. So.
Right. Yeah. I mentioned that dangling a carrot, it's more like dangling a ding dong, right? You can have a ding dong, everything in moderation. Mr. Heroin Addict, just take one shot up the arm. Moderation. But I digress.
Something's by definition aren't moderate, like heroin. There's no moderate use of heroin.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Exactly.
It's not possible, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll smoke cigarettes every now. The baby can smoke cigarettes as long as it's just one.
Yeah.
You'll hear me go off. Let's go back to the body mind connection. You have any great stories you can share about where maybe something that was overcome through therapy, where you caught something big? Any great examples?
Well, I could certainly give you one of my own, like in my own life, why it became such a big deal. So I had all these health problems growing up, and I spent a lot of time trying to figure them out. And that led me into all kinds of, you know, different kinds of therapies and looking into it, trying to figure it out. And one of the things I figured out at some point is I could use my mind to help my body do better with specific exercises. And so for me, I literally think that saved my life when I was trying to find the right doctor who could diagnose the problems I had. Because at one point I had like 14 infections or something running in my system. And I think I have like a 2% chance of being here with all that going on. And I think I was able to function because of my ability to use my mind and my emotions to keep my body moving forward. And so using that connection, I was able to drive myself forward. And that's changed everything. I don't think I'd be here without it. I wouldn't have a career without it. I wouldn't have built all the methods that I put in the Vitality method without it. So for me, it's the reason I'm here. I certainly use that with my clients all the time, you know, trying to help them adjust what they're doing and how they're feeling. And I have some people that see me regularly just trying to get through the difficulties in their life. So they're working three jobs and they got a bunch of kids and they're a single parent. So I'm using all kinds of tools to help them connect and get through that trying time for them as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I see, you know, I gave some examples in my introduction about where I've seen it and, you know, bigger than that. And I don't have definitive proof, but I'm a two-time cancer survivor. And I think there's the connection between, you know, we all have these precancerous cells in our body. You know, it's a matter of whether we activate them or not.
Right.
Or not. Right. And we can see how what we eat, the environments we're in, and stress, how that could impact our bodies to ignite, you know, those cells. And on the flip side, you know, so I do believe that, you know, it's potentially my internalizing the emotions in my life lent itself to those cancer cells activating. But on the flip side, I also feel I have this, and it's not a positive attitude. It may even be a mental block that says, I'm not going to die. I've just got to deal with this.
Right.
It sounds like a positive attitude, but my friends know, my friends and family, I always joke, which is like terrible. I joke that like I'm immortal and I cannot be destroyed. Like that's my line. But that, you know, when I was diagnosed with I had this tumor or growth inside my lung. I said to the doctor, well, just get it out. I don't have time for this. Just get it out.
Yeah.
Like that was my attitude. And it's not that I didn't do what I was supposed to do. I went for chemotherapy. I did some holistic treatments. I stopped eating meat. You know, I eat except for when I'm having, you know, my food issues, my addiction issues flare up. I don't eat sugar. You know, I changed my lifestyle. But, you know, I'm 17 years, more than 17 years cancer free now. And I think a lot of that has to do with believing, you know, that positive mindset that tells me to do what I need to do. Do what you got to do was my Relay for Life team. We called it Do What You Got to Do. And, you know, so in both ways, I feel my mind contributed both to having cancer and surviving cancer. It's, you know, I'm not a doctor. I'm not going to tell you, you're never going to get cancer or you only got cancer because of this. I actually was very resentful from someone who said, oh, you brought it on yourself because you're so overweight.
Right.
I was like, well, you know, my episodes are called WTF. That's just rude. Right.
And kind of attacking. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks. Cause I didn't feel bad enough as it was. Now I brought it on myself. But anyway, now we're in therapy. So how would you address this for me?
Well, I think there's a lot of things there. You know, we kind of miss that mind-body connection and how the emotions fit in. I really like to talk about those as three separate things because your emotions should be getting as much attention, I think, as your mind and your body in terms of health. But you can watch people, you know, and I've watched it for years. I've been cancer survivors and people who survived AIDS and all kinds of things where they felt like their mind training was just as important as what they were doing with their doctor, you know, in terms of pharmaceuticals or surgery and those kinds of things. So there's a lot of interesting things in terms of the connections of what we have and being really careful where your mind goes is important. And so that's part of that. I'm going to make it through this. There was a point when I was really sick, and then I got surgical infections on top of it. And I was going, I wasn't like hooked up to a machine, but I was basically dying in my experience, at least. And I was like, I'm not going out like this. Are you kidding me? I'm not, you know, that's how I remember thinking about it. It's kind of a similar thing. I was like, I'm not going out like this, you know, and here's how I'll get through it, you know, and I don't care what happens. I'm getting through this. And then all kinds of things began to change at that point for me. Like something changed within me when I was like, I'm getting through this. And if I have to make the method myself, then I will. Then I did, you know, and I still did what the doctor asked me to do. I still did what my acupuncturist asked me to do. I still worked with a therapist, you know, and I'm not saying I didn't do any of those things. But a lot of the things I had to build on my own saved me. And a lot of those are mind, emotion, body connection. And so a lot of ways to do it.
Let me ask you, I'm going to put you on the spot. This isn't in any of your paperwork or any of your books, any of the previews I got. Does spirit play a part in this? Mind, body, spirit, we hear.
I would say absolutely. Yeah. And I would say spirit in this context is what you are apart from all those other things. So you can make your mind completely quiet. You can make your emotions feel like they're kind of quiet as well. You can get away from your body a little bit. And what you have left, I would say, is you. And it's that spirit part of you. And that's the same part of, I think, you and I that were like, yeah, I'm not going out this way. I got more to do here. I'm going to find a way through this. And I actually think that came from that level. And then your mind is like, oh, okay, we're going to change this. And then the body's like, oh, I see we're going this way. Your emotions, oh, we're going that way. And so they begin to follow you, the real authentic you outside of all those things that are things that you can use, like your mind, your emotions, and your body.
Right. I had another question, but it blipped my brain.
It happens. Yeah.
So, oh, here's the question. You don't just author books, you work directly with clients, right?
I do. Yeah.
Okay. So can people find you to work with you? Is there an opportunity? Do we want to tell people where to find you to work with you?
Sure. I have a website, nitality.com, and that's nitality.com. And you can reach me there through email, and we could set something up if you wanted to talk to me and work through things. I couldn't do a lot of the somatic things I do in the clinic because I would need you in the room with me. But a lot of the methods I have are definitely made to work with your mind and your emotions. We could do some kind of like coaching with that. I wouldn't call it therapy, you know, in that case. And I'm not a psychotherapist, you know, that kind of thing. But certainly if you wanted to talk about my methods and how they might help people, and I could walk people through them, I'd love to do it. I'd love to share some of this. It's like my huge passion to try to get this to people. It's my favorite topic, you know, and I want to make sure that I share what I put together with people who could use it.
And I'll have those links to reach you in our show notes.
Great.
Are you also on social media?
I am. So I'm on Facebook, and it's my full name, Todd Nils Nyholm. And then I have an Instagram, which is pretty active, and it has that Nyholm Vital Life method. I started it before I abbreviated the name. So that's out there as well. And I'm building a YouTube channel, and I want to put a lot of the information up in video form. And if you just search Nitality, you'll find me there.
Great. And your books are available on Amazon?
Amazon, Barnes & Nobles, Apple Books, like 9 other places I'd never heard of until I found out where they could go. But it's all over the place now.
Excellent. And I'll have links for that as well in the show notes. So that leaves me with, are you ready for the speed round?
Absolutely. I'm excited.
Excellent. All right. First question. What is it that can always make you smile?
I'd say working some of my meditation methods, because I designed them to actually boost up your emotional health and your hormone health. And so there's some really cool methods I made that if I walk around a park and I do those, I'll feel like pretty high, like not in the sense of drugs, but similar kind of effect where I just feel wonderful doing it.
Yeah. All right. Question 2. Besides the city you live in, what is your favorite U.S. city?
I really like going to New York City because I had a lot of family there, a lot of wonderful experiences, going to shows. And I live in Wyoming now, which is almost the opposite of New York City. It's quiet.
Yeah.
There's like 7 of us here. And so there's not, it could be really quiet here. So
where'd you grow up?
Us in Denver.
Oh, okay. So you were not a New York guy, but you have a lot of family there now.
Yeah. Both my parents came from New York just a little before I was born.
Gotcha.
And so we are back a lot. Yeah.
Question 3. If the toilet paper roll is really low, but not completely out, do you replace it or leave the last squares for someone else to deal with?
I replace it. And it's partly because of an experience I had with a girlfriend who would leave me one square. And it just drove me crazy because I can't do anything with one little square on the toilet paper.
And you know what? Elaine from Seinfeld said, you don't have a square to spare. It's like a famous Seinfeld episode, if you remember it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Next question. If you were a talk show host, who would you want as your first guest?
There's a yoga master named Sadhguru. Actually, Sadhguru is the title, but everyone knows him by Sadhguru. I would love to have him as a guest. He's a really interesting guy and an eloquent speaker. It'd be great to have him there.
I'm going to have to look him up.
He's pretty interesting.
All right, your last question. What are you having for dinner tonight?
I haven't decided yet. I'll probably have some soup. So I have some soup made that I like to eat in the evenings. It's kind of similar to a sausage, potato, cream broth.
It's a hearty soup.
It's pretty hearty, but not so heavy that it makes me feel tired at the end of the day. But I like it quite a bit.
Awesome. Well, we've reached the end of the speed round. I hope you had a good time. Was this as good for you as it was for me?
It was. I enjoyed talking with you, and I love talking about this stuff. So I'm glad to be here and talk with you about it.
Great. Well, we'll have all the information in the show notes. Everybody go out and get your book, Ah Brain, Why Do You Trouble Me So Much? And if you're a food person like me, Ah Food, Why Do You Trouble Me So Much?
I love those titles.
I do too.
They make me laugh. Yeah.
Me too. It definitely caught my eye.
I'm glad I wanted to.
Thank you. Thank you for joining me. Visit agileselfdevelopment.com and subscribe to the podcast so you can receive new episodes right when they're released. And if you enjoyed the podcast, I'd love it if you'd leave a review in Apple Podcasts. It makes a big difference in how the podcasts are ranked. Thank you again for joining me, Helene Coppell, for this episode of Agile Self Development. Become your best self, one version at a time. Catch you soon.